800-735-0230.
And we are at the top of the hour, and we have to go. This is a fun drive that does end. It's not endless, but it goes for 10 more days till Black Friday, right?
Right, but we return the airwaves back to local station programming. Thank you.
You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. And now for something completely different.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
They can fill it.
Stuff that turkey.
It's Technology Bites. Thank you. Have a good night.
Hi, welcome to the show. This is Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
I'm Dwight.
And he's...
Oh, Groove House with the closed mic.
Perfect yeah. Show.
Perfect show.
Yes.
Stuff that turkey.
Perfect show.
Light that rocket.
See if you can figure out how many people are actually in the studio.
I don't even know, and I'm here.
I guess
who was that
up?
Talking over the intro?
Some new guy. I don't know what's going on.
I think it was the end of the fun drive.
Yeah, and then they ran
the
off.
Prior deal.
Can't believe that was very unprofessional.
Let's see. First, the information about the show. You can find a lot of stuff about us at geekradio.com. Not all good, but you can find it. And let's see. We have the IRC channel at irc.cuckoo.com.
Cuckoo.
Which is a Pound Tech Bites.
It's the show within a show.
The chat room. It is the show within a show. And what else is there? What other things do I know? Oh, you can possibly call if it has something to do with the topics we're talking about. And actually tonight, as you may have guessed from the intro, we have Dwight Silverman, host emeritus, as a guest. I guess, are you a guest or just...
I'm feeling I'm keeping
hosting.
This seat from floating away.
He represents
and the microphone.
All the cats.
And the yeah, the microphone is trying to float away. Or the microphone is missing a spring, and so it leaps up for me periodically.
It's just excited to
Please
see.
Please give to KPFT.
And
so it sounds like we need a fundraiser just to pay for this.
And we're going to have a special guest caller partway through the show to give us a hands-on review of new technology. We'll let you wonder who and what.
So there's been a shift of power, too, without getting too deeply into it, inside the studio. And I'm not just talking about Dwight being here and Jay Lee being gone. far as Windows versus Mac goes.
Barrett's brought in some foreign technology.
A swing. That's right.
We were all Windows for a while. That's right. Yeah, and then Flicted. I was surprised Flicted's usually the guy that goes first, but he dipped his toes into the Apple pool. Actually, Pete's always been there, so we don't even consider that because Pete's such a fanboy.
Yeah, I've been a Mac before that. Justin Long even knew what that was.
Yeah, but see, I didn't flip until they went Unix.
To go thin and silver, though, I didn't either, really. To go thin and silver, though, Flicted was the first.
Oh, yeah, I bought the first-gen MacBook Air.
I forget the order. Who got the next Air?
Yeah.
That might have been me.
So how do you like using Windows 10 on your Surface Book?
Yeah, say what it is.
It's a Microsoft Surface Book. And I want to call it, like, Surface Book Pro Edge. Like, there's so many Microsoft Surface words out there. Yeah. But this is the one that is kind of like an amped up. And we talked about it a little bit, I think, in preparation of it coming out.
How many of the gigs does it have?
I don't know. This is the best one you can get until January. So it's a i7. Pretty decent processor.
It's got a lot of gigs.
It's got a lot of gigs. Yeah. SSD drive. Only 256, though, I think, on the storage. Huh. But the cool thing with this is that the top part, actually, transformer detaches from the base unit. The base unit has a battery. Screen has a battery. And there's actually an additional GPU inside of the keyboard. So when you dock it, you get a lot more power. You can flip the top off. You can flip it around. I was on an airplane, some air flights, in and back and forth around, and was able to kind of turn it around and watch it on the seat back or watch it from the seat tray table, even though the guy in front of me had reclined completely all the way, which would normally break, a MacBook Air or something if it's in that divot. But this, I just flipped it around and was able to watch it at a nice viewing angle, while still having a little bit of, passive aggressive, bumping the seat every 20 to 30 minutes. With my knee.
And it's got a big old stylus hanging on.
Yeah, yeah. And then it's all magnetic, too, which is kind of nice.
Pretty cool.
Now, the weird thing is that it's got kind of a new, alien Wrath of Khan antlion larva kind of looking hinge. And in the Air...
Do they call it, a faceted hinge or something?
Yeah, there's
like
a word. It's a cool word. Fulcrum. It's a fulcrum is what they're calling it.
It's like a roll top...
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the deal was that the top part is so heavy because it contains a processor that they had to extend the base out a little bit so it wouldn't just hump over when you had it in laptop mode. But the end effect is that when you're in the Air, it's got a little wobble that just never stops wobbling. But that's not that bad. If the seat had been up, and I'm going to keep harping about the seat. If the seat had been up, I could have popped it against the seat and there would have been no wobble.
That
keyboard base and just had it.
That laptop is dubstep.
So I still haven't got the answer to my initial question. How do you like using Windows 10, having been using a Mac and Linux?
So here's the deal. Most of the stuff that I do on here is like secure shelling into other servers, and it's kind of OS agnostic. Although I will say this, a couple things don't work. LibreOffice, a lot of the documents. The documents you can open up. But on a Windows share, if someone else has it open and it says, hey, would you like to open Read Only Notify? That dialog screen completely blacked out. Just some oddities like that aren't quite worked out.
Weird.
Can put virtual PC or Parallels or that. They have that for Windows, don't
they?
Yeah,
I just haven't had enough time to trick it out yet.
Help me out here, see if I can remember. Does PowerShell do SSH natively now, or do you still have to install PuTTY to use SSH on this thing?
I always install PuTTY just because I can control my font sets and my colors and everything that. I've got a configuration file that I just threw around, so it's easy for me like that. But, eventually this will have, hopefully, be dual-booting Linux. But there's so many specific drivers. That's the other weird thing on this is it is a magnetic lock, but it's software-based. So I don't know if there are hooks that go into Windows 10 or if it's pure firmware, but something in the firmware triggers and gives a signal to the Windows operating system that says, hey, we're unlocking you. But if you don't have Windows on there, I'm not sure what the story
what would
is.
Happen.
So, yeah. So this is one of those things where I really don't want to make a brick of.
You don't want to be the first. I think that's where Google could be your good friend.
Yes, I'm going to let someone else go first on this.
So here, we'll do this up and so that we're...
Ooh, Dwight is just a chameleon.
This is terrifying. Dwight's got Windows on his MacBook.
That's right.
Like, I've got that
OS.
So
I wrote a book about this.
Literally.
And I love running. I actually love Windows 10, at least as a... But the only reason I mainly run it is so I can run Windows Live Writer for my blog, which is a free old program. And that's what I write in, and that's pretty much all I use Windows
for. I will say this. I've gotten really used to going to the Windows button again. And it was also odd going from a single mouse back to having to do scrolling on the left-hand side and doing some oddities like that back in the Windows world.
The two fingers.
I've got it dialed in now, but it only was doing two fingers on one side of it for a little while. Like you could tell it came out left side scroll. It was it just wasn't dialed in like OS 10 is when you just get it and it just kind of works.
Right.
Although I still have to on OS 10, I still have to go back from the regular up down to the goofy view because I like the video game style.
which
like when you scroll
the
up,
natural
go up.
Scrolling versus
thank you.
No, that's
the other
terrible.
Scrolling.
Mac has wrecked you for that's, Windows.
That's terrible. For, natural scrolling.
It's the scrolling for people that like to touch the screens of laptops.
It's terrible. It's horrible. And
so are you on my side on that?
You should, no, natural scrolling is horrible, and if you like it, you should be ashamed of yourself.
Okay.
I like natural scrolling. Is the new style.
Oh, well, time out. So I don't like natural scrolling, so right. I should hate myself.
Why?
Now I'm confused.
When I go down, I want the screen to go up.
And don't we all?
I don't know what I
want. Don't we all?
Okay, that's what I want, too. I want this way, like this. I want basically to be in a one-to-one relationship with the elevator bar and my fingers. That's what I'm... That's
yeah, but
what
when
I'm
you go down, for. Your screen goes up.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Like,
so what is that called?
Bar, that's non-natural.
Unnatural.
That's old school.
Okay.
That's the old school.
Because the idea is,
that's OG.
Tablet, if you push forward or up, then the page scrolls down, the indicator goes down.
So I'm not natural.
Page scrolls
you're
up.
You know,
but, nor is
but,
Lee.
But no. Apple or somebody even had that, like, I remember what OS it was, where if you had a page, like a web page, and you had a scroll bar on the side, if you push the scroll bar up, the page went down. It was like it was.
That's normal. That's normal scrolling.
Yeah,
that's standard old school. Everywhere since
the indicator bar though goes the indicator goes down to show the page has gone farther.
Yeah,
it sounded like you're describing an opposite of that, right?
Yeah, the natural scrolling is where the finger quotes natural scrolling is where when you move your fingers down, the content goes down as if you were dragging
in the same direction,
you
like it was a touch.
Right.
Grabbing the...
yeah. No, but I'm not.
That's not.
I'm not talking
not
about
traditional
with the
scroll.
Like with the direction of the mouse. I'm talking about like the sidebar.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think a
scroll bar.
Yeah. So
the
scroll
bar.
Elevator
bar.
Like
so you're almost talking about
if
like
you
a
move
window
the,
shade.
Yeah.
Where you go like,
like
this
if
and
you
it goes up.
Move
right,
the mouse over and grab the scroll bar and drug down. Usually it was like it was attached to the page, and if you went down, the page went down.
Yes.
But I don't remember if it was old OS 9 or something.
No, that's weird.
One of them, it was the opposite. Like you
would
grab it, and you would pull the sidebar down.
No.
And the page would go up.
When you pull the sidebar down, the document does go up because that's scrolling down. That's scrolling the viewport down. It's basically viewport scrolling versus content scrolling.
There was one where it was opposite, and it was annoying.
You outed yourself on OS 9, too.
Yeah, I did that. I had to do that for work. I took over a job of doing, like, finite element models for the space station from a guy, and he was on a Mac, and so
from
in order...
From a guy? Are you sure it was a real space station? It was just some guy you knew?
Hey, you
want to
work on the space station? I know a guy.
So he... When he left, I took over his role, but he used a Mac. So I had to take the Mac in order to have access to the software and all the models that he had on it. So that's when I started using a Mac. And I learned that I didn't really hate them like I thought I did.
I learned heart Claris works.
I learned in high school that I hated them. And now I have one.
Well, it's full circle, I mean, Apple II, Apple IIe was kind of what I kind of
thought. I never had an Apple back then. I had Commodore 64.
We used nothing but Macs in high school journalism, and that was around the OS System 7 days, where trying to get the one laser writer we had hooked up with Apple Talk to work, and it would never work, and you had to fight with the chooser for like an hour to make it work, and I was like, Macs are stupid, and I had that opinion forever.
That is only because at that same time you were not trying to set up printers with a PC.
Not network printers, anyway. All I knew is my printer at home just worked.
Yeah, you had that Centronics 50-pin connector, you
plugged
it
in. Just worked.
Right.
I can network all of 8 feet. That's all I need.
All right. Well, why don't we hit the news? We'll have Flicted push the button.
Push the button.
And,
push the button.
I got to get to it first.
Push the button!
Preparation.
Y'all didn't give me enough time to prepare for that.
Press the button! Oh my gosh. What is this happening? There we go.
It's the Technology Bytes Info Shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
So here's an interesting hacker article. I never thought I'd see this day. The trade in secret hacker techniques known as zero-day exploits has long taken place in the dark, hidden from the companies whose software those exploits target, and from the privacy advocates who revile the practice. But one zero-day broker is taking the market for the hacking techniques into the open, complete with a full price list. In an unprecedented move Wednesday, the zero-day broker startup Zerodium published a price chart for different classes of digital intrusion techniques and software targets that it buys from hackers and resells in a subscription service to customers, including government agencies.
Guess what else will take about 0 days to get broken into? They painted a big target out there, I think, for themselves. There's going to be a lot of people gunning for that website.
Well, the deal is, you know, that basically they've opened a market so that people know what they can sell it to.
Well, an above ground market. There's always been kind of lists floating around, but it's never been, like you said, it's never been out there.
So, the first rule of the 0 day biz is to never discuss prices publicly, said Zerodium CEO Chauki Bekrar. In a message to Wired prior to revealing the chart. So guess what? We're going to publish our acquisition price list. An attack that can fully remotely take over a victim's computer through his or her Safari or Internet Explorer browser, for instance, fetches a price of as much as $50,000. For the harder target of Google Chrome, Zerodium's price rises to $80,000.
Like they have these exploits, or that's what they're offering
to buy them for. Okay. And, of course, the people have to guarantee that they won't release it to other companies or to the public.
It's like the evil side of bug bounties.
Remote exploits that entirely defeat the security of an Android or Windows phone device go for as much as $100,000. Is my mic a little low?
So there are more bugs. I actually have you up pretty high.
Sounds fine to me.
Your headphones may be low.
Oh, maybe. maybe I have defective headphones. Or if I swap them.
Maybe you have a defective head.
There you go. No, I think everybody listens through the right
the
ear.
The polarization
on their
was wrong.
And
I use the
so
left.
The other ear.
I use the left as well.
The other ear was much softer. It didn't sound like I was getting much. Okay. Remote exploits entirely defeat the security of an Android or Windows phone device go for as much as $100,000. And an iOS attack can earn a hacker $500,000. By far the highest price on the list. So one of the things from this kind of market that you can learn is the value and relative security of things, because obviously if it was easy to come up with an exploit, they're not going to pay you very much because it's not worth very much. So although also I guess the iOS thing is if you can get into theirs, you're kind of golden. Zerodium is keeping its fresh hacker techniques under wraps for its customers, which it says include government organizations in need of specific and tailored cybersecurity capabilities, as well as corporate customers, it says, use the techniques for defensive purposes. The subscription rates are at least $500,000 a year for access to the exploits. Obviously, he wouldn't name any specific customers, Bekrar's last startup, the French company Vupen, I'm sure that's probably how they pronounce it in France, more explicitly offered its zero-day exploits to customers it described as government agencies within NATO and NATO ally countries.
He said, I won't mention any names, but their initials are.
So the revelation comes just days after Zerodium's hacking techniques affecting common web publishing software like Drupal and WordPress sell for just $5,000, according to the list. Perhaps more surprising is that an exploit affecting Tor, the anonymity-focused Tor browser, only fetches $30,000.
Kind of tells you what's already broken.
Well, yeah, that comes just days after Tor claimed that the FBI paid $1 million to Carnegie Mellon for a technique it had developed to break the anonymity protections on Tor's server-focused hidden services feature. It's also far less than the $110,000 the Russian government reportedly offered for a Tor-breaking technique last year. The Bekrar emphasized in an email to Wired that Zerodium's Tor bounty was only for vulnerabilities in the browser, which is adapted from Firefox, rather than vulnerabilities in the Tor network itself. So, the high price for an iPhone or iPad attack still comes in at just half the reward they offered in an open bounty last month, in what Bakrar says now says was a limited time deal. The company very publicly agreed to pay $1 million in late October to a team of hackers who proved they could successfully compromise an iOS device that visited a malicious web page through its Safari or Chrome browser. Even at that reduced price, an iOS exploit is still worth 5 times as much as any other technique on the chart. Apple users may be dismayed to learn that the ability to compromise their personal device is as much a commodity as any other hacking technique, but at least it's expensive. And Congress, your Congress, working, we talked last week with our guest, with Sci Guy, our guest...
Eric Berger.
Eric Berger. The Congress picked up some space stuff. Too bad he's not here this week for that news. U.S. Commercial Space Launch Competitiveness Act soared through both congressional houses with vacuum-like ease. First and foremost, the bill protects private spaceflight from regulatory oversight. So see how safe you feel when you go get on one of those commercial rockets for the next 8 years. It gives the industry up to 8 years to get its innovations in place before government overseers step in and start counting rivets. But more interesting, if less immediately applicable, the bill lets entrepreneurs keep whatever non-living souvenirs they find out in the void, opening the door to everything from asteroid-based gold mines to comet-collected rocket fuel. The next step in this is President Obama's desk, but apparently he is likely to sign it. Hey, you know, let's start a business where we go up and get expensive satellite technology that we find out there and sell it back to. I know there's some expensive cameras out there that like got dropped on space missions and
there are. And such. There are some extremely expensive 70mm Hasselblads just lying on the moon.
You know, we just need to find a customer for a giant glass lens that only has minor imperfections. The Hubble Space Telescope went dark this week for
Oh yes. Well,
anyways, some of this is, it's one of those we're trying to find a balance. Obviously, going to space is a risky business. And I guess the idea is that right now we're not up to the level of, commercial airplanes. Although then on the positive side of regulation, once like regular people are doing this, then you want, FAA level airline caliber inspection and all of that. I've heard lately it's maybe not as good as it should be, but
maybe
the fact
better
that we
than
don't
TSA,
have
yeah.
may, that we don't well not TSA FAA mm-hmm. the maintenance on planes. I mean, there's a reason that the United States hasn't had a like mechanical failure crash in how long, with a fatality in quite a long time. So obviously it's early days, so it makes sense to do that. The other thing is space mining. The legislation okayed, you came for the newly authorized space mining, although that what the legislation okayed is actually broader than that. The bill gives a company working under a U.S. license the ability to own resources that they might obtain from celestial bodies. That's great news for companies like Planetary Resources, tagline, the asteroid mining company. But it might not sit so well with other world governments because there's a bunch of space treaties that say that, basically that governments can't lay claim to celestial bodies.
That's right. The primary one is called the Outer Space Treaty.
They're so clever with those names.
Also,
that was the 60s.
They couldn't come up with a great acronym.
It was the
like,
60s.
It's the Prime Directive.
Like Trek or private, basically, there's all these treaties that have established that governments cannot lay claim to celestial bodies, but private individuals could keep the stuff they find. But the selling of said claims by private companies is hazy territory. Because these companies are regulated under U.S. law, it could be interpreted as saying that these celestial bodies are U.S. property. So they do have – the law does have a paragraph saying that these claims are not declarations of sovereignty. So you can't go start your own sea land on like a passing comet and get away with it because there wouldn't be sovereignty under the law.
What if you plant a flag?
Do you have a flag?
Through the clever use of flags.
Do you have a flag?
Let's see. So the sections of the bill, those sections of the bill are already spurring international debate, but probably won't come under real scrutiny until the UN Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space has its annual meeting next summer in Vienna. The end of the Wired article I found this in says, let's hope they go better than that time Riker faced off against the Ferengi for control of a wormhole. there was a lot of discussion of it the past week. After the thing in Paris, after the attack in Paris, one of the big things that's been discussed a lot is encryption.
Right. There's been a lot of false and misplaced bloviating about how the terrorists allegedly used encrypted communications, when in fact evidence points to them having used unencrypted plain telephone SMS text messaging. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Just yesterday, CIA Director John Brennan said he hoped the Paris attacks would serve as a, quote, wake-up call, unquote, to those who oppose government surveillance in favor of personal privacy.
Whatever. Brennan is an idiot.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you can send your complaints to idiotciadirector@aol.com. Oh,
Brennan,
wait. No, that was...
Brennan's the kind of person that makes me proud to aggressively use encryption wherever I can, even when it's not necessary.
Well, a few people did that. Like the New, I saw an article yesterday by the New York Times, and they put it out there, you know, tying encryption in, and they quickly, you know, made it go away, even
they
though
did,
it was still out there on.
They did, because they were wrong and
well,
stupid.
For a while, yeah. For a while, the rumors were that they had used PS4s to do the encryption.
No, hold on. You only use PS4s to do rocket telemetry.
It's just mad.
Or missile guidance systems.
Or to practice your raid in some kind of very realistic...
It's absolutely mad.
Your solid
environment. What uncovers, frankly, what uncovers, you know, bad actors in situations like these, whether they're in the continental U.S. or internationally, is old-fashioned, solid police investigative work. And that wins every single time over, you know, theoretically being able to crack encryption.
And snitches.
Yeah.
So, yeah, yeah. Pretty much, yes. Yeah. All the old-fashioned things that always work, that always will win over being able to do, you know, metadata gathering and encryption breaking.
The big thing in the UK that they've been trying to push through is the Draft Communications Data Bill, which is nicknamed the Snooper's Charter. And that is the one that pretty much lets them – it says that no strong encryption. We need key escrow to everything. And that's what, I mean, 3 weeks ago, they were really trying to get that through. There was a watered-down version of the bill, and then after this, it's back. Everyone's calling for it again, which is a really, really bad idea.
Well, Brennan harped on a few of his common phrases. He added that terrorists have gone to school, unquote, to figure out ways to evade intelligence officials. Really, because, you know, before all of this, terrorists, what, they used to go out to lunch with intelligence officials and talk about what they were planning.
Totally.
But nowadays, it's just changed so that criminals and terrorists are now being all secretive and stuff.
It's just really disappointing.
Brennan also attributed that fact in part to Edward Snowden's disclosures of the National Security Agency's bulk data. Yeah, I mean, it's like, stop me if you've heard this before. Just a day before the Paris attacks, the NSA's former general counsel, Matt Olson, told an audience gathered in Des Moines that after Snowden came forward, the agency, quote, lost track of terrorists, unquote. Meanwhile, FBI Director James Comey has been an outspoken critic of encryption, arguing that it enables criminals to, quote, go dark. You know, the deal about it is they're going to – well, let's see. Remember September 11th? There was that really incredible encryption, like calling things a birthday party or a soccer game. Oh, well, and that was all encrypted. No, it was they spoke in code. Mm-hmm. So how do you – you know, so even if you do word recognition and all that, how do you distinguish between people planning for next week's Thanksgiving dinner and somebody planning an operation?
Well, that's exactly it. And this may eventually change with a lot more companies doing encryption by default, like WhatsApp. And I guess, you know, like iPhone is doing their texting. But right now, if you use encryption, that's painting a huge red target on your back and saying, hey, I'm probably talking about something you want to listen in on, so they're capturing all of that. If you want to eke stuff by, you do exactly what you do. You know, turkey and stuff on holidays, and you hide.
Yeah,
and that's how they're going
to. Now you've told them what to do.
Oh no, we've enabled terrorists.
You're in collusion.
I'm sorry. Go back to using encryption, terrorists.
So I'm using an iPhone. Does that mean that I'm probably a terrorist?
You are suspect.
Yes, you are. If you checked the box in iTunes that says to encrypt your backup, which means which turns encryption on the device, then yes, you are a terrorist.
Oh,
you are a terrorist, Dwight.
Barrett, I've got one of those. Should I use one of those?
I would go
instead?
To Samsung. What if you go to Gitmo, who's going to take care of the cats?
You actually probably should switch to Android because they're so terrible about their encryption and like saying that it's on when it's not on. And the Android ecosystem's approach to on-device encryption is so inconsistent and awful that, yes, they probably really would prefer it if you switched over to that.
I'm on it.
So,
that was such a left-handed compliment. So on my carrying.
Look, it's true
Android.
When they
it
fix it.
So as we go into the political season for the presidential election, I would suggest that you look at candidates about their positions on encryption.
It doesn't really matter. They're pretty much
decide if they
terrible.
Line up with what you. Decide if they line up with what you want.
The new boss will be the same as the
Ben
old
Carson
boss.
Said. I got a decoder ring once out of a box. A cracker.
Ben Carson actually invented encryption when he was building the pyramids.
He was in the pyramids building, you know, on his free scholarship from the.
Now, what Ben Carson claims to do, Dwight can. We talk about an OS, Dwight pulls it up in a VM. We talk about a phone, Dwight produces the same
really
phone
does.
From
That's
another
awesome.
Pocket.
And then the final
I
news thing. Here's hackers doing something that I think what they are kind of ideally suited to do. Anonymous came out after the Paris attacks and has said that they are going to besiege the ISIS militants with massive cyber attacks, which, you know, annoying people online, I do think Anonymous absolutely has the skill set to cause lots of headaches and frustration. And so I think this is probably a good one.
Did you see the picture, the meme generator that someone had posted where it was a picture of of a fellow in a Guy Fawkes mask like the Anonymous folks wear, and it said the caption was something like, you know, Anonymous declares war on ISIS, and then below it was like, not the 72 virgins they were expecting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's excellent.
So there's a guy, he's a security blogger, and he's not necessarily, I don't think he's associated with Anonymous, but he started, I guess, ferreting out some of the darknet sites that ISIS and ISIL are running and publishing all the, you know,
Krebs?
How to connect and stuff like that. It's not Krebs. It's the guy that runs, I never know how to say this, Cryptria? I don't know.
Cryptia.
But it's a WordPress blog. But yeah, he kind of gets into the bulletin boards and how they're going dark and, you know, kind of how to go about hunting them if one was so inclined.
At the very least, you know, in the days following this, now the number of Twitter accounts that are down that are ISIS, pro-ISIS Twitter accounts, the number started at like 4,000 and it's gone up from there. They've actually, you know, that they're saying, and they've done this before. And there was a pretty large number. There were thousands of pro-ISIS Twitter accounts.
See, here's the thing. If you want to stop terrorism, you need to shut down Twitter. Seriously, take Twitter away from everyone. Take Facebook away from everyone. Make everyone give up all the technology, and then they're going to have to go back to communicating. You know, that's how you do it. Don't worry about encryption. Just
then cans and string. Then only criminals will have cans and string.
No, outlaw long string.
And I see by the clock that it is the perfect time. We have our guest, our mysterious mystery guest, who is going to give us a hands-on review.
Wait, dude, Dwight, why don't you spin us an intro to your mystery guest?
Hands-on review of his technology.
Mystery guest.
We're waiting.
Are we ready to put our call on?
Are we ready?
Who's, are we bringing him up, or is Groove doing it?
So this is Jim Thompson, who has been a longtime friend of the show. He guest blogs and tech blog periodically. He was on a spate while I was sick doing it, and I really appreciate it. And one of the things he wrote quite a bit about was his excitement, thrill, and joy that that Apple was releasing the iPad Pro. He went and bought one and has been fondling it for a while, and I asked him to come on and talk about the experience.
Hey, Jim, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much. So I was just wondering, as I was sitting listening to you guys talk, how many of you are really in the studio, and who's dialing in from New Zealand?
Jay Lee is absent. We are in Fly Geek formation, although we've got more than we usually do.
We had virtual Jay at the beginning of the show.
We will say, though, that also, I think the other big credential here is creator of the Blinken Box.
That's right.
Oh, yeah.
That's huge street
for
cred.
Regular Geek Gathering attendees, that probably is the most quick indication of who we're talking about.
Yeah, if you've seen this this strange-looking guy carrying around a tackle box that blinks red and blue, that's probably me.
And the Blinken goggles as well.
Yeah, and the cool goggles. I remember that from the anniversary party.
Oh yeah, yeah. I love my Bluetooth goggles. So yeah, I've been wearing those every now and then. So yeah, Dwight. Dwight's right. I was really excited about the iPad Pro. It was about time for me to upgrade anyway. I upgrade every other iPad cycle, so I had the iPad 1 like the day it came out. Didn't get the next one, got the iPad 3rd generation. Didn't get the 4th. My previous iPad to the Pro is the Air, so I did not have the Air 2. So it was about time for me. Anyway, yeah, Apple kind of squeezed things a little bit because they normally come out with the new iPads in the first few months of the year. So to have one coming out in November was pushing it a little bit, but I managed to convince my my finance manager, who I also call my wife, that I really needed to get one of these. So
that macaroni cheese from the box was what you needed for Thanksgiving dinner, so you could purpose that money to your iPad.
So what makes you say, okay, why did you even want something this big? You know, I spotted one at Micro Center and played with it briefly while I was there, and it was like, that doesn't work for me. And so what was it exactly, even before you had it, that said, I want something this big?
Well, it wasn't the size. I didn't say I want something this big. It was the new pencil and the ability it gives you to write on your iPad or draw, in my case, in ways that you couldn't previously. I mean, with a great level of detail and, you know, in the shading and the pressure sensitivity and all that. Previous styluses for the iPad have sucked. I mean, there's just no other way to put it. They have this big, typically big, like a eraser at the end, and it's like the size of your fingertip. And when you draw, you can't see the pixels beneath it, so you can't see the pixels that you're actually drawing, because it just, the physics of it, it just blocks the view. So that's what I've always really interested in. But as you probably know, if you've seen any news at all about the new iPad, is that these accessories did not ship as soon as the iPad hardware did. In fact, I'm still waiting for my pencil and my smart keyboard to ship after a week. So I'm a little cheesed at Apple for that.
You can borrow the one off my Surface Pro or my Surface Book.
I don't think it works the same way. So what is the when were you promised the pencil and the keyboard originally, or were you?
Well, there was no promise. I mean, when I bought it, it told me 1 to 2 weeks lead time. And, you know, so now I wasn't expecting that. I was expecting them all to be on sale at the same time, naturally. I mean, why would you not expect that? But so when I was checking out at Apple, and I like bought my iPad within the first 5 or 10 minutes that they were on sale, because I stayed up that night and I was waiting. I was, you know, clicking refresh like every few seconds. Well, maybe not quite that much, but you get the picture.
Right.
So before I checked out, I saw that it was going to be a while, and I thought, surely that's not real. That's not true. So I went ahead and ordered them anyway, because I'm going to get them regardless of when they come out. But so I got my iPad the next morning, and still waiting for the pencil to even ship. I haven't even gotten a ship notice from Apple about that yet.
Some people have started getting notices on that. But they're expecting current estimates from some customers have the Apple Pencil arriving between November 20th to 24th.
Have you been to the Apple Store and said, do you have pencils by any chance?
You know, I haven't done that. But the impression I get is that they're, you can't just walk in and get one. Maybe you could the first day, because they had put a few of them out there. It doesn't even give you the option to pick it up. You know, when you check out from Apple, you have the option of shipping, or you can, for most things, you have the option of just going down to your store and picking one up. And that option isn't even available.
So what do you think of it? Even though you do not have the pencil or the keyboard, and all it is a big-ass tablet, what do you think of it?
Well, I like it. So let me talk about a few things here. Yeah, it's big. yeah, it's awkward at first. And in fact, some of the things are awkward even after you get used to the size. For example, when the on-screen keyboard is different for the Mac Pro versus for the Air. It for one thing, it's got more letters and numbers, so you don't have to type a you don't have to hit a special number key to enter numbers. They're all up there in an extra row of keys. So I guess Apple's taking advantage of the extra pixels that they've got. But if I'm holding it in landscape mode, it's just too wide to type. Now, here's something else that cheeses me off. They don't give you the split screen option anymore, at least not on the iPad Pro. You know, it used to be you could slide your thumbs up and the keyboard would divide in two.
Oh, so that on
all the keys. Yeah, I mean the on-screen keyboard, yeah.
And on the apps, so that, it'll do the split screen, right, on the iPad Pro, right?
No, it doesn't.
No.
I can't get that to work. There's not even an option for it in the settings. It's like they've, for some reason, decided that they just want to torture people.
Well, since iOS 9 allows you to have third-party keyboards, have you looked around to see if someone has done a split-key keyboard for it?
You know, I hadn't thought about looking for somebody to do a split key there. I have noticed that I have this typewriter out called Hank's Writer. It's this thing that Tom Hanks created or had created for him. And it actually can install its typewriter-looking keyboards in place of the normal on-screen keyboard, but they don't have a split option. And it just seems completely at odds with all sense that you have this big iPad, and when you hold it in landscape mode and you pull up that keyboard, surely that's a situation where you would think people are going to need a split keyboard. And my hands are reasonably big, but even that's a stretch for me. So if I'm going to type, I typically turn it up into landscape mode. So anyway, I kind of don't like that. But
That reminds me a little bit of the inability to have a Bluetooth keyboard with the new Apple TV. You know, it was something.
Oh yeah, that makes no sense.
Yeah, it was something that was available in the old Apple TV, and there's no reason not to have it, other than that they
would
force you to use the voice search, which isn't available in everything.
Right.
And if you do need to type, you've got that ridiculous horizontal keyboard.
Yeah.
So it's a similar thing to that. It sounds like.
Yeah, it is. That's something else that makes no sense. But to get back to your original question, Dwight, yeah, it's big, and yeah, I found it awkward at first, but I've gotten used to that. It really took me maybe a day to get past that, except for the typing. I have to hold it a little differently depending on what I'm doing or how I'm sitting. But it was funny. After just a few hours of using the big iPad, I went back to my iPad Air to do something, and it just seemed crazy small. It's like, what is this? This is a toy. My fingers didn't. It was just weird. So I have to say, I think I got used to the size really, really quickly. It's got a nice big screen on it. It's big. It's bright. It's beautiful. It's got more pixels. Some of the apps are just stretching. They haven't updated to take advantage of the pixels. So the iPad kind of seamlessly stretches them out a little bit. But that works. That works fine. The sound, the four speaker design is wonderful. It really sounds good. The first thing I did was I played AC/DC's Hell's Bells, and I went, "Wow, that sounds great." and then I pulled up a Bach unaccompanied cello suite, and I went, "Wow, that sounds great." So it just sounds. It's just hard to describe how much better it sounds than my iPad Air. It's not just the additional speakers. It's those new resonating cavities they put back there to boost the bass, and it really does sound good. Really does sound good.
Do you have a case?
It's fast. I got one that covers the back because the keyboard will cover the front.
Right.
So I got a neoprene. It's something that Apple sells. It's got their logo on the back. That fits it pretty well. So it's fast. It may not be as fast compared to the iPad Air 2, but compared to my original iPad Air, it's really fast. There's a couple of racing games I like. They're Real Racing 2 and 3. Real Racing 3 would run on my Air, but it was the frame rate was real stuttery. It was real lots of drop frames. I run it on this new iPad Pro, and it's just buttery smooth. And there's a sample program they came out with a year or maybe more ago, a Zen demo. It shows off the metal interface and the Unreal 4 engine, and that's just that would kind of tax my iPad Air. But on the Pro, it's just everything works. I mean, it's just super smooth. I don't see any drop frames.
So what do you think the upgrade threshold is? What iPad would you have to have right now to make upgrading to the big iPad worth it?
That's the answer. There is going to be, it depends, you know, on who you are and what you like about your iPad and what you want to do with it. So good question. Probably if you have an Air or an Air 2, if you have an Air 2, you might want to skip it. If you have an Air, it just depends. If you have anything older than that, it's probably worth upgrading. Although it is expensive. I mean, it's crazy expensive, even for an iPad. It's of course, I always get mine decked out because I know I'm going to have them for 2 years, so I max out all the specs, and I've got the 128 gigabyte with cellular.
Does it have Does it have a large text mode? Because I know, I'm looking at this kind of thing for my dad, and my dad is not that old. He's in his late 60s, but he is definitely the kind of guy who takes his screen resolution and jacks it way down so all the letters on the screen are gigantic.
All the letters are big.
Yeah, is there an option, an accessibility option on the Pro to take advantage of the screen that's big and make, really big letters?
That's a good question. I don't know that because I haven't looked for anything like that. I do know that most of the apps, for example, iBooks, you can make this text as big as you want to naturally, but with more pixels to use, you can get more of the page on screen even with the big fonts. I'm going to look here real quick while we're talking at the settings, and I'm going to see if there is a accessibility option for that. I haven't seen one. Yeah, there's a larger text. Let me turn that on and see what. Actually, I think I've seen this on my older iPad. It's a slider where you can change the natural text size, and I guess it's the size that it uses in the system fonts and everything.
Oh, that's handy.
Pardon?
I said that's handy.
Oh yeah.
Although it will give in certain apps, if you do that, it kind of makes certain apps the fonts in menus come out of alignment and they overlap each other.
Yeah.
So you will. There are some trade offs to doing that. Do you have you taken it out in public?
No.
You haven't?
I was at a
car wash over the weekend, waiting for my car.
There was a guy
in the waiting room who had an iPad Pro, and this was like a big guy. He was looked like he was probably, former football player. And he's sitting there, he's holding it, and he's big, and it still looked big with this guy.
It wasn't like to scale in his giant hands.
No. It still looked big. The only thing I could see for me doing it is if I was really interested in doing photo editing or drawing. Mm. I know my daughter is interested in that. Who likes to draw is interested in the pencil, And I'll be interested to see if in the next iteration of the iPad Air, if they don't enable it, the pencil to work with that. Because I think there's no reason not to down the road.
Yeah, except they're Apple and,
Right.
they don't always do the obvious.
Yeah, or else it'll wait till the next iteration on the Air, then that feature might get down, and then maybe it'll get to the Mini when... in 5 years or something. I guess it'll be interesting to hear back from you when you get the keyboard and all that. Do you see this as something that with the integrated keyboard and that would be sort of how close do you see it to being a laptop replacement? I know that comes up.
Okay. Yeah. I hear people talking about that a lot. For me, it probably wouldn't be because I do some things that require, special apps that you can't find on my iPad. Software development, for example, you can't. Although I've heard rumors that maybe Apple is working on a version of Xcode that would run on the iPad Pro because it's certainly got the horsepower to do it. Xcode, I can't run Xcode on my iPad Pro. And I think for a lot of people, it's going to be, that same kind of answer. Yeah, but I could, email and documents and all that. I've got Office 360 on it, and with the split screen mode, I could see that being really, really handy. But I just those special purpose apps, and everybody's got one or two of those probably, where they go, I could use it as a laptop replacement, but for, something or other.
I wonder if one of the things I think I see happening, not this year, but in the future, would be kids, where you buy that. Instead of buying the kid a laptop, you get them an iPad Pro, and they end up using, end up by going from the start, and then they're more oriented on that kind of device than they are on a regular laptop.
I thought you were going to say so that instead of having a kid, they use the money to buy an iPad Pro.
Well, I'm sure there's some people doing that too.
Yeah, can you bring it to the next Geek Gathering?
Do you have
Absolutely.
A pickup?
Yep.
Yeah.
And hopefully by then I'll have the pencil.
Yeah, right.
So and the keyboard.
And Barrett
I was thinking of actually doing that.
Barrett can bring his Surface Book, and we can have a...
We can watch your iPad Pro bully it from size, from per size.
Yeah, I would love to play around with the Surface Book. They seem to me like they're, it's pretty good hardware.
That's why Barrett bought it. That's why he said he bought it.
Yeah, we're staring at Barrett's right now. It's quite nice. I have to, bang them against each other.
Is his the Surface Pro or the Surface Book?
Surface Book.
Yeah, it's the book, the keyboard.
The book, yeah.
And the pencil.
Yeah, so.
I'm sorry.
And a boo.
Low shot.
So you probably had a little bit of your own sticker shock, huh?
Yeah. Luckily, this was a work purchase. I would not spend that kind of money on my
own. That's a great angle. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, thank you, Jim, for calling in. We appreciate it. And we're looking forward to actually being able to attempt to pick it up when you bring it to
together. Yeah, well, you need to do some more of that weightlifting, so you build up your wrist muscles. So,
I'm on it.
Yeah, is there any truth that you've named it Thor's hammer?
Yeah, and don't read that in bed upside down at night. I mean, a cell phone to the forehead is an annoyance that could actually decapitate somebody. Careful.
Yeah, no truth to those rumors.
All right. See you at the Geek Gathering,
thanks
Jim.
Thanks for calling
in.
Thanks for having me. I'll see you.
All right. Awesome. Well, that was Jim Thompson.
One of these buttons will get rid of
Yeah, we're actually the, as if nothing else needed to be broken, our nice little keypad here in the studio also has broken
So
buttons.
It is.
Well,
it
was like that before I got here. At least it's the button that makes sense that it would break, which is the, put line one on the air button, which I'm sure gets a lot of use.
Whack, whack.
All right. Well, I guess we got a few minutes before the top of the hour, maybe we'll just, going on from the iPad Pro thing.
Yeah.
Probably should have done that right before we put...
Yeah, we kind of bit the apple already.
Jim Thompson on. So we got a few things that build some on I mentioned while Jim was calling in about that some people who ordered the keyboards immediately, which it sounded like he did, so I was kind of disappointed that he hasn't been told that his is shipping. But the first online orders listed delivery dates of November 19th at the earliest. So some pre-order customers, it seems like that's already been slipping. So, but they are happening. People are getting their pencils and smart keyboards. But it sounds like most people ordering them, especially if you're ordering it now, you're talking about early to mid-December as delivery times have slipped into next month.
Ouch.
No. In other news, this was an interesting one. DisplayMate tested all of the current iPad screens.
And these guys, by the way, are legit. This is Dr. Ray Sanyera and his bunch of technology guys. When it comes to like screens and stuff, these guys are like the final authority. They are super smart.
And the thing about it, the main reason why it kind of makes the news is you know, the Mini has been sort of the orphan child, bastard child of the iPad line. And in the DisplayMate results, the iPad Mini 4 was the top best of the new iPads, of the current gen iPads, had the best was the best screen according to them. Now, you're talking about slight. It's not like the iPad Mini 4 has a great screen and the other ones suck. It's that, you know, when they hashed all the numbers and went through all the stuff, the iPad Mini 4 came out on top. Now, some of that, you know, I think a lot of it was in color accuracy was something that they really liked. And the job is easier on the smaller screen, obviously, to get the kind of good Retina display. And so, you know, most of the stuff was real similar between them, but you know, they were all their conclusion was all very good to excellent top tier displays. So don't over you know, I don't want to do the kind of lazy media thing and make you think that the iPad Mini 4 is just so radically superior. It's just sort of a surprise though that the sort of smallest and cheapest of them is the winner. They say that it is close to being a textbook perfect LCD display in all of the lab measurements and viewing tests.
Wow.
So, you know, yeah, for again, you know, because the iPad Mini, they've kind of given finger waves. I mean, I know the Mini 4, they boosted the horsepower a good bit, and but generally the Mini has been one that it's like Apple's been sort of ignoring, and so it's sort of surprising that it ends up with the best display. And other things, you know, in contrast to
wait, maybe we should put a fork in that.
Oh, just real quick, in contrast to Barrett's Surface, Tim Cook has said that Apple won't combine MacBook and iPad. They're not going to have a converged tablet and computer operating system.
I have some thoughts about that, but
so we'll talk about
and
that
also,
when we come back.
What else do we have coming after the break? We have Dwight's magical Apple TV review that I've been looking for.
So there's all kinds of reasons to stick around, and we will be back after a few short messages. I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
I'm Dwight.
And he's
Groovehouse.
You can find KPFT on the social networking sites Twitter and Facebook? You certainly can, and we'd love you to add us as a friend and get us connected with friends of yours. Join our fan page and check out a special video message from General Manager Dwayne Bradley, as well as keep up with KPFT programmers and staff. Visit facebook.com/KPFT Houston to join us. To follow us, visit twitter.com/KPFT. With both, you can link up with other KPFT listeners, get the latest news about the station, and find lots of extras. It's fun, so catch up with KPFT online. Again, on Twitter, visit twitter.com/KPFT. On Facebook, visit us at facebook.com/KPFT Houston. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, 90.1 KPFT Houston.
The Pacifica Foundation, the parent organization of this station, is now holding elections to seat boards of directors in each of the foundation's five signal areas. By the time you hear this announcement, ballots will have been sent to qualified voters to participate in this year's local station board elections. Please make sure to open your ballot when it arrives, read about the candidates, educate yourself on the issues relevant to the station, and cast your vote. Local station boards help shape the direction of this station. Your vote makes a difference. Check Pacifica.org for information about the candidates, process, and more. This is KPFT Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. Now back to Technology Bites.
Hi, welcome to the show. This is Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Bite of the Apple. What? What's going
What's
on?
Happening?
Jay's sitting in a hotel in New Zealand freaking out right now.
My world's confusing me.
Well, yeah, we're going to continue. You're reaching the continuing Bite of the Apple. And when last you heard from us, we were talking about that Tim Cook had been saying that the that Tim Cook declared that the iPad Pro is a replacement for a notebook or a desktop for many users, but that they were not going to put together, they were not going to merge iOS and OS X. Cook labeled the Surface Book a, quote, diluted, unquote, product for, quote, trying to be a tablet and a notebook, and it really succeeds at being neither.
You hear that, Barrett's Surface Book?
In other words, Tim Cook called you out. We no longer wish to be relevant as a company. I'm going to miss Apple.
Well, it
had a good run.
Yeah, they did, you know, all the way up until that whole turtleneck loss and then went south.
Well, you know, he certainly, given, you know, from our prior segment with Jim Thompson, having the iPad Pro, so you're talking a high-end product.
How is that a great idea versus
come out with kind of large glaring omissions and not being, you know, in certain ways it sounds like it's kind of unfinished. And the software, the system software doesn't seem to be up to the device they just released. That is an evidence to me of a bit of slippage on
there
Apple's
is
part.
I think from the last three Apple products, the Apple Watch, the Apple TV, which I wrote about, and the iPad Pro, I think that's endemic to all of the things that we've seen so far, is that they feel almost like beta products. And to a certain extent, Apple's done that before. I think the first iPhone was unfinished. The first iPad was largely unfinished. And so they come back later and do it. But these have almost a feel like, okay, these are the things we can stuff in it now. Let's get it out the door.
Yeah.
It has that kind of that kind of feel.
Because it doesn't seem like they evaluated it. Because some of it should be that they should have known that people using
it
were going
to stumble across. Well, there may also be design decisions. So, for example, the idea of not having, they probably didn't think, or even want people to be doing the two thumb thing on, figure it was too far apart for most people. But what they want you to do is they want you to buy that keyboard.
Yeah. There's gets into
margin.
That smells a lot like the worst days of Microsoft, where it's like, oh yeah, you want this software? Well, I'm sorry, you're gonna have to update all your hardware, and so you have to have the latest operating system, which only runs on the new hardware. Which, you know, I mean, there was that whole Microsoft two-step between Office and the OS.
To Apple's credit, they are one of the few companies where when you have a phone for a long, long time, you can get the new iOS update.
They actually do that better than really anybody else.
Right.
They really do. And
it doesn't always run quite snappy, but it will work.
iOS 9, I believe iOS 9, Arch did a thing on that. Arch Technica did a thing on that. Every time a big iOS update drops, we try to find, like, what's the oldest hardware that we can run this on? And I believe iOS 9 will run still on an iPhone 4S. I don't think it'll do the 4, but I think it'll run on an iPhone 4S. Although run It's really more like it'll walk on the iPhone. It doesn't really run at all. It's extremely slow, but you don't, I mean, you can still get most of the new feature. Obviously, you don't get the fingerprint reader. You don't get the, I don't, you do have Siri, but it doesn't have any of the, all the Hey Siri, like instant on stuff. And there's obviously no Apple Pay. There's a ton of stuff missing, but you don't have like this brick that is dropped off the update charts and won't get security updates or anything ever.
Apple does need to be careful. I mean, in the same line of them being complacent, I think with Microsoft putting the Surface Book out there, and realistically what they're doing is they're going up against the OEMs that they've never really competed against. They've always sold software to Dell, to HP, to all these other companies. But what I'm hearing, what I'm seeing is I think Apple, I'm sorry, the Microsoft saying, hey guys, like, this is not acceptable, our offerings, you know, Apple's killing it in the hardware department. We're going to show you how to build something, and if you don't get on board and build something this awesome, that's too bad. They're going to buy from us and not from y'all.
That was kind of the intent, right?
Yeah, I think so, but what that means is...
Here's how it's done.
Yeah, it's like kind of like the Google flagship when they, you know, when they did Android early on, but I think that's going to eventually, give it a year, there's going to be a lot more competition out to all the Apple goodness sitting all around me. So Apple really does need to get... I do want them to be around.
Well, but here's the thing with the Surface, though. Like, that was, like, the idea was indeed, like you said, kind of to put out, here's the reference design, and then OEMs, if you want to jump on the bandwagon, it has to do X, Y, and Z here. The requirements go. But the problem is, I mean, I know, you know, Dell has released viable Surface. You know, they're not quite clones. Dell has released viable Surface alternatives under their licensing agreement. And Acer has some. And I know there's a couple of other OEMs that have kind of jumped on that bandwagon. But frankly, compared to Microsoft's Surface offerings, everything else out there in the Windows tablet space sucks. It's nothing is anywhere near as good. It doesn't have the build quality. It doesn't have the thought put into the design. You know, Dell's stuff is approximates the functionality cheaply.
XPS 13 is nice, but that's kind of the word. It's like when you pick up, you know, like a MacBook Air, it feels really solid. I seriously considered an XPS 13 from Dell, and it looked on the outside kind of Apple-ish, but it still had bits of plastic and kind of bits of cheapness about it. Yeah. So
I think the problem, the PC manufacturing world has been so used to being fast followers. So somebody would go step out, and they used to sort of hand off. It's like some of them would do a line that really kind of pushed things forward, and then the rest of them would knock it off. Well, now none of them are sticking their neck out.
No.
And so they're busy following each other into tighter and tighter circles of cheap-ass hardware.
They've all been racing to the bottom. They've been trying to shave stuff off and get, you know, teeny-tiny margin points, and that's why, you know, you look at the IDC numbers, the PC market continues to contract, even while Apple continues to not contract. They continue to increase year-over-year sales in every category except iPad. In every category except iPad, Apple is up year-over-year on everything. They're up on portables, they're up on desktops, and mobile, obviously. and everybody else is not.
So not to ask scary questions, but do you think because Apple has become kind of a status symbol, like people like to be seen with Apple gear, and people that aren't necessarily like hard geek, hard tech types, that Apple can now coast on not necessarily being technically awesome, but being more of a stylish kind of accessory, kind of look good in a coffee shop kind of hardware?
I think I see some of that, frankly. I don't – maybe – so I said this last week when Eric was on the show. I said that – in talking with Dr. Asif Siddiqui about Apollo and the Soviet space program, Dr. Siddiqui said that Apollo skewed our perceptions potentially of what a real space program should look like. Apple's ridiculous success in the Jobs era, the second Jobs era rather, that that time from 2001 through his death, that decade, might have really screwed up our perception of what a computer OEM should look like, because there really hasn't been, with the possible exception of Apple in the late 70s, again, there really hasn't been just a rocket ship rise and dominance like they did. You know, category creation, device category creation like they did with a couple of different things. I mean, computer OEMs just don't act like Apple has acted. And a lot of news agencies get a lot of stick for talking about Apple in such glowing terms, but in a lot of cases it's justified because it's just so otherworldly what kind of position they're in.
Some of the pushback is getting bigger, though.
Just this week,
I didn't put it in as a bite of the Apple thing because it's a little esoteric, but Togg, if you're an Apple fan, if you know who Togg is, just
Togg
by
solid.
That, Bruce Tognazzi,
yep.
Who was a big Apple design guy way back.
It's the guy who formulated and wrote a lot of their human interface guideline stuff, right?
Yeah, and he was talking about that basically, yes, the designs look beautiful, but they've lost the, you know, having it work, the look and the design appearance has begun to outweigh functionality and usefulness. And that, you know, the thing about it, though, is Apple can afford to, they can afford to not do all that well for a lot of years with that pile of cash they've got. Now, I don't think they would do that. I do hope that, you know, so the kind of perpetual, complete, thorough devices they've put out, I can see where that there had to be an end to that streak somewhere.
So they're not staying hungry anymore.
I don't think so.
But
not
I think
as much.
They'll get, you know, some of it though is they have standards for themselves, and at some point they're going to go, yeah, this isn't up to the Apple standard, and so we need to not put out this device or not put out this new thing, and do it right or go back. You know, the thing, some of it is that you know, one of the odd things you talk about, they put it out and it's sort of not done. And then the second generation, usually it really starts hitting its stride. The MacBook hasn't had its second gen, which I'm the just regular MacBook. Mm-hmm. I saw them. I was in the Apple store for something. I saw one in person, and it's like it had that. Ooh, I got it. I would really like this based on looking at it and the form factor. I didn't play with the keyboard a lot, which I know people have some issues with, but the look and the Retina screen, and so getting that compared to an Air, the MacBook looked superior to me, except, you know, it's been out for a while now and they haven't put the new processor in it. It's underpowered. When every time they talk about the iPad Pro, they mention that, of course, it's really kind of got more horsepower than the MacBook. You know, if you're really deciding. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I hope that Apple is not, you know, there's got to be somebody there who's got their eye on the ball. And it does seem like on a lot of fronts, they're just doing permutations of the things they did before. They're not updating as quick. You know, I know there was the problem at Intel with the processors, but, you know, how long should the MacBook? They're starting to discount them, so I wonder if we're coming up after the first of the year.
I hope so. Mac Rumors says super, super stale, red light, don't buy on all that. You know, you look at the product cycles, and usually it's like, you know, a couple times a year, but you're right, we're pushing like 318. I'm not looking at it, but it's up there. We're coming up on a year since the last refresh on those.
If you're an old-time Apple user, surely you're used to delays about, you know, CPU issues and stuff. We're going to get to 3 what was it? We're going to get to 3 gigahertz on the desktop one day. Was that the G5 speed that was never that they were never able to hit, or was it 2? I don't even remember, man. That was 10 years ago.
I just want to hear Pete wax on about the Newton again, cuz that makes me happy. Just at least one mention somehow. I don't care how you work it in.
I remember speaking at the FM 1960 PC users group around 2000, and if I had just used a few extra different words, I could have been the friggin' Steve Jobs visionary.
Started a revolution.
I talked about the Newton because I used it and what it did, and it had been discontinued by that point, I believe.
They killed it. That was Scully's baby.
The thing is, though, you know, the iPhone owes a lot to it. They had a lot of knowledge and experience that they got from doing the Newton. But I said, you know, imagine it with a color screen, and if you didn't have to use a stylus, and with a lot with more capacity, just the natural flow of things that would be coming. And yeah, it took them another 8 years or whatever. But the iPhone is a Newton.
So have we? So has Apple really ever gotten past the Newton? Or is this kind of where we are, just Newton version 10?
The Newton, though, was, you know, evolutionarily was sort of was for a long time sort of a dead end for them. I mean, it was out of their normal.
But it was kind of a visionary, kind of putting it out there kind of thing that didn't have, and I don't know if they thought they had an immediate market for it. When I read like some of the history stuff, it sounds like it was kind of sketchy. They hope, but they
not,
didn't know.
It was not cheap. I mean, you had to pony. I was fortunately working for a Fortune 100 bank, one of those too big to fail banks, and so I was doing pretty well
and plus being able
to afford it.
The Newton was a product of that era when Apple was sort of throwing everything against the wall to see if it would stick. That was when they were making digital cameras. They were making the Pippin.
They made the first real consumer digital camera.
Yes,
so they weren't
yes.
just making digital cameras.
No, they were.
Well, they too, with iSight. That was one of the first. Right, yeah, I mean, Logitech and other people had done it, but they made one of the coolest ones. That's what I'm saying. That aside from iterations of, you know, laptops and iPhones and tablets, I want something cool and new again.
Well, but that's what, I mean, that was one of Jobs's first things on return. You know, he killed all the clones, killed all the clone agreements and said, we're not going to do that anymore. And, you know, finished out their obligations. And he took the product spread and basically just said, like, you know, here's every, like, look, I can't see my hands waving in front of me. Here's everything that we're currently making. We're going to take about 95% of that and throw it away. And then we're going to take this 5% left, and we're going to do it really, really, really good, and that's it.
But also, when he did that, he was working with a company that was at death's door.
Yes.
So he it wasn't, if he had walked into a healthy Apple, he may not have stripped it down that much.
No, I agree. But you, I mean, you were actively reporting on Apple at the time. You were heavy, you know. Dwight, I was saying before the show, you're part of the Houston tech news scene. I mean, what were some of the things that you guys were saying in the news about Apple? And, you know, what was that, 1997 to 1999 time period?
There was a death watch going on, right?
Yep.
The thing with the Newton, though, if you really looked at it, the Newton was what was making money at Apple at that time frame. They were about to. They were really, when Jobs came back, Newton was being spun off as its own company. And it was making enough money from selling Newtons. The Newton 2000 and the 2100 were both, they had enough power. That first Newton, you know, the whole egg freckles, that came out too early without enough power and all that. But when they revisited it, people were blown away. When I had my Newton, they were blown away by it, and it showed the promise of what a PDA could be. I mean, it wasn't the ultimate end one, but compared to everything else, to a Palm Pilot or those kinds of things, it was way beyond. And if you looked at the numbers, if you looked at at Apple's business numbers, Newton made money. Apple computers were losing money. They were losing money on everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then the one thing that was like functioning and working that was going to go off on its own, Jobs killed it and kept. But he also kept every one of the important people from the Newton project. He didn't just turn it loose where somebody else could pick it up
and repurposed them on something
and started. So
you know, one of the things I remember was that iconic Wired magazine cover,
Prey,
with the Apple with kind of the crown of thorns on it and Prey across the top of it.
Yeah,
and that's how close it was. You know,
it really was.
They were circling the drain.
They were at $18 a share. Was that was like sort of the low deal?
$18 a share with Michael Dell saying, "If I were Apple, I would liquidate the company and give the money back to the investor."
Right. June of 1997. Yep. Yeah, is when that Wired cover hit.
So if you've been unfortunate enough to see the Steve Jobs movie.
I heard Fassbender does a really good job.
Fassbender does a good job of it. It's just horribly overwritten and poor choice of timing, I think, on the part of the writer Aaron Sorkin. I reviewed it and I gave it a really bad review. But one of the most interesting things I think in it is it's set with three different acts. The first one being backstage before the iMac introduction.
Right.
And he has just come back to the company. Wait, is that the no, it's the Mac introduction. It's the original Mac introduction.
84 Mac introduction.
Right.
Yeah.
And then it is the next introduction and then the iMac introduction, correct? Or is it?
No, I think it's the original Mac, the iMac, and the iPhone. And the iPhone is
no,
the
he one. Doesn't do the
doesn't
iPhone.
Do the iPhone?
It's the next. It's his next. And then it's the iMac.
Okay. So it's the candy.
So he talks
IMAX.
About the iMac. He talks. He's talking to Scully, the guy who's playing Jeff Daniels, who's playing Scully. Who, when I look at him, I constantly think of the guy in the newsroom, Will McAvoy.
Yeah.
But he talks about how, you know, when I came back, you had 30 days of cash before you were going to have to shut the doors, and that's how bad it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is. The Apple then and his choices then as to what he was making in no way reflect kind of what you're seeing today. This is a really healthy company that you have to grow in order to be successful. And in order to grow, you got to do new products. And I think that they're so intent on getting new products out the door that they're doing them. They're essentially pushing betas out the door.
One of the things, though, that Steve Jobs said, I call him Steve because, you know, yeah, we're totally tight, me and Steve Jobs. One of the things he famously said in 97, I think it was one of the 97 speeches when he came back either for one of the keynotes that year or afterward, it was when Microsoft had just dumped a tremendous amount of money in and co-invested, was he said that, I'm obviously paraphrasing, I don't have it in front of me, but we have to get rid of the idea, we Apple fans have to get rid of the idea of thinking that for us to win, Microsoft has to lose.
And for he got booed for saying
he
that.
He got booed for saying, well, because right. at that time, I mean, that was like, you know, the companies were at each other's throats, and Microsoft was in the very much in the power position in that relationship, even though their money was for non-voting stock.
The money was partly for Microsoft to keep Apple around so that they could show there was a competitive market.
Well, and that turned out to be, I think, you know, some of the best money that Microsoft ever spent, because I don't think anybody could argue that the PC landscape just worldwide hasn't benefited from their continued existence, if for nothing else, as a minority competitor, minority from a market share standpoint. That's forced every other OEM on the planet to step up their game or fail. I mean, you've got this beautiful, Barrett, you've got this great Surface Book that is, you know, a hot piece of hardware.
Inspired by?
Well, even if you don't say it's inspired by Apple's work, it's caused by it. It's been driven to
unibody,
production by it.
Slim, you know. Feels good in the hand. That's kind of where things need to go. Indestructible.
The entire landscape's better for it. We're all better as consumers for the fact that we've got multiple companies that are all kind of doing a kick-ass job at producing great hardware. It's just a great time to be alive,
well,
I guess.
There's a thing, and I think Apple maybe, you know, has succeeded itself into the problem. One of the things that I said in the 90s that was an issue with Microsoft is at a certain point, the power of the business, you know, the money, the cash flow, the sales, by them doing anything, it would generate money. Put out a new version of Office, boom. Well, they always, you know, on the stock thing, they always came out, and Bill Gates always, this is going to be a really tough quarter. We don't know if we can even possibly make any money, blah, blah, blah. And then they always beat it. And then the stock market would go crazy and, raise the price of Microsoft. But in those times, one of the things that I said is the problem that they have for being big number one like that is the kind of people who want to go work there are the people who want to go work for a big company that's got a lot of money sloshing around, not the kind of people who want to change, who want to make something amazing happen. And at that time, Apple was obviously very hungry and very desperate in that. Well, now you've got to wonder, what is Apple getting as far as people? There are still the ones who believe, but you know, you keep seeing these people pop up that have been in Apple's history who are saying, hey, you know, you seem to be off the path, and putting out products that are not as, you know, obviously some of them that when Steve Jobs was there were not kind of fully complete, but they were revolutionary enough that nobody, you know, that the iPad was still successful and the iPod and those were still successful, but they could have been so much better, and then they did get better.
Now one of the things I will say that is that having I haven't got an Apple Watch, and I don't have the iPad Pro. I do have the Apple TV. The Apple TV, while definitely mostly has a lot of potential, it still is a pretty cool product. And of the streaming boxes I have, and I've got a Fire TV and a Roku 3 and this.
You kind of run the gamut.
It is an excellent streaming box, and it's the one I prefer to use. There are things about it that drive me crazy, but I can tell that when these little things are fixed, and they're all fixable, it will be a real joy to use. The Siri feature, and being able to talk to it and say, to tell Siri with your voice, turn on the subtitles.
Or to tell Siri, who's the actress in this movie, and yes, what else was she in?
That's right. Yeah. In fact, to be able to do that is a real step ahead. To be fair, Amazon's Fire TV does that now already.
Echo to an extent, too, with music and with some things.
Yes,
you know.
Yes. There's a feature that's on the Kindle tablets, and it's also on the Fire TV called X-Ray. And it does that exact same thing. It shows you kind of what's in it and gives you details about it. But it is done better, and it's more interesting on the Apple TV. And so while I think it probably could have used a little more time in the oven, it still, I think, is the best streaming box out there.
Well, and looking at their financial position and their market position, they could screw up really, really bad a lot of times. And still, I mean, it's kind of like the Titanic at this point. You know, you don't just turn the wheel and the company turns. They've got tremendous financial momentum going on in developing markets. I mean, gosh, you listen to their financials. They're making the majority of their money at this point. Well, the majority, that's not fair. They're making a ridiculous amount of money at this point from expanding marketing into China, iPhone sales in China, portables in China. They've got this huge retail tailwind. They're making buku money, and they're kind of on inertia pretty much no matter what they release. Mm-hmm. Maybe what it comes down to, and maybe I'm off base, but maybe Apple is a company where the best only comes out and it only performs its best when it's up against the ropes. And it would take a tremendous amount at this point to put them in that position. But
you'd hope maybe they would look at, you know, you look at Google and what Google's done. Obviously the jury's out on how well that's going to succeed. But that idea where Google stepped back and said, okay, we're more of a holding company for a lot of different ideas that we want to try.
Yeah,
so let's open
Alphabet.
The door Alphabet, to trying yeah. those things. Imagine if Apple did that. I mean, with some of their resources and that and some of the people they've got, if you have, you know, think back, you know, basically the old, you know, one of the old stories of Apple where they had a pirate flag outside the office building that was the Mac building, you know, where they were building the first Mac. You know, that kind of attitude where it's like, yeah, get the small team, go into your lab and keep it quiet and secret and build your thing. And do
there are a lot of talks out there on YouTube now where young Steve Jobs, you know, actively admits to stealing things and ripping things off and even walking off with hardware from work and, you know, stealing ideas.
Oh, yeah.
But they're very closed-minded when it comes to developers now. And, you know, I track, like, which languages are kind of rising and falling. And Objective-C, you know, that's one of the quickest dropping languages. I know Apple's moved over to Swift, but they're getting a lot of flack in the development community because they keep changing the tools. It's like, you know, with Windows, you learned C 20 years ago, you can still write C. You learned VB 20 years ago, you can still write VB. If you invest a lot of time to write applications for Apple, one, you got to jump through a lot of hoops to do it. Two, you got to pay some money, get licensed, and they're very restrictive on what you can do. And then every 3 or 4 years, they completely change the game on you.
Or you can have your app treated like a second-class citizen if you go try to have the traditional route and don't abide by
That said, if you talk to developers who work on Android apps or iOS apps, almost all of them say they would prefer to develop for Apple because the tools are better and the design is better and they're more profitable. They make more money.
Because they ditched the legacy. I mean, you end up with the part of Windows' problem was the boat anchor of their legacy code that they had to carry around for way too long.
Other Android, thing, you can choose a few languages, though, with Android.
The other thing, Barrett, is you say they used to do this. They used to go off in small teams. And how do you know they're not now? They're such a black box.
I said that.
Yeah, they're such a black box. Yeah. And actually, I can't say what I know, but don't count on that they're not.
I would hope that they do. That's where I was going with it. Is it seems like, though, because their products have been kind of monolithic lately, you know, now they're adding more things, but that there's a lot of following in Steve Jobs' footsteps. There's a lot of high level executive attention to this stuff that, you know, if you do it right, like Steve Jobs did with the iPhone, you get good results. If you do it wrong, you get, maybe you could say, the watch.
It may just be the glare from the Surface Book, but the twinkle in Dwight's eye gives me kind of hope about Apple again. It seems like he's in the know about some skunk works or something's going on. So I'm prepared to be impressed again.
No one has come to me and said, this is going on. But from talking to certain people who I know who are involved with certain things and kind of connecting those dots, there are certain products that Apple has in the market now where there are plans for development that are best done with these small teams working like that. I think an obvious example is, okay, the Apple Watch, right?
Yeah.
So there's so much potential in that. and there's so much more that can be done with it, you can just bet that there are people kind of working on very specific things that would be connected with that, with that product, or with wearables in general.
Yeah, I hope that they, you know, I hope that they maybe consider, though, even having multiple teams working that, that are doing their versions of it and competing. I know there's a lot of stuff that gets done at Apple that we just don't even see it, that they look at it and decide it doesn't go to.
You see it in their patent filings.
Yeah, and then it never, and you don't really see it.
Or it is used in some different way than you would expect.
But it, you know, I think the watch is an interesting one. I mean, they're trying to, they do dominate the smartwatch market, but the smartwatch market isn't that large. And I just, the thing that I wonder about as I look, you know, as I consider buying one, whether or not I would buy one, is I don't like to think of the idea that I would need to and want to replace my watch that costs like an iPhone, like a pay for it without any subsidy iPhone. I'm not wanting to replace that every 2 or 3 years because I don't see that they're going to be able to give me something that's that compelling in the couple of years, you know, that I'd rather wait now and get an Apple Watch that really blows me away from the beginning, not, oh, well, it's got a lot of potential, I'll buy it now.
So there, so in terms of watches, so I'm the son of a jeweler, and my father worked for Zales for years, and I worked for him in my high school and college years, and he assigned me to the watch department because I was like, I'm into watches. And so, but one of the things I know about watches, and when you look at the Apple Watch, and there's this whole argument about, I don't want to have to buy a new watch every year when a new one comes out. That's one segment of the market. But people who are into watches have a lot of watches. They're both fashion as well as function. And so I know people who are really into them who have 7 or 8 watches, and they're all expensive. And they wear them like jewelry. And they're men and women. And so when Apple looks at the market for watches, and the average person just who may or may not wear a watch, or if they wear a watch that's a smartwatch, they wear one. Apple's looking at the way people buy fashion watches.
Yeah.
And that's there. So someone, if they do next year when they introduce it, I guarantee you it will not look much like the one this year. It's not going to be another square slab. It'll be thinner. It may be round. There may be multiple designs for it. And when you see that, you'll know that they're trying to make a smartwatch a fashion object as opposed to a tech object. And you'll buy one because it's different than the one you bought last year.
And they got ridiculed unfairly, I think, and incorrectly for the high-end pricing. For you know, they have the pricing runs the gamut, kind of, right? But there were several offerings they had from, you know, the I forget what it was, $2,000 or $3,000 on the entry high end, all the way up to the, you know, the top end watch edition in rose gold with the special band that could run up to, you know, $12,000 or $15,000. I forget how much it was, but
and they got a lot
of 15K, yeah,
they got a lot of stick for that. But that's not necessarily out of the range of a top end or even a mid range fashion watch, right? I mean, you've got these things that can run $20,000-$30,000 at the really, really high end.
I think part of that though was the people who buy the $17,000 rose gold, you know, edition watch edition. Proportionally to them, that $17,000 is like us paying $50 for a Timex at the, you know, up impulse buy.
Maybe it's like paying $100. Maybe a little more than that.
So the reason I think that they got a lot of stick is because when you look at it and go, oh, hey, well, okay, so I'm looking at it. There's this sport one that's plasticky that looks sort of like a Swatch smartwatch. And that's what? $350? Oh, that's the small one. But then $400 is the one that probably is the size for a man. And then, oh, well, what if I want the like metal band thing? And then it's $1,000 roughly. To the people in the just normal swath of society that were looking at that, that's a big, you know, there, most of them don't have that for fashion, I guess would be the thing.
Yeah, right.
And so I wonder if it's a miscall on Apple's part.
Well, no, that's not the market they're going. They are not going after you and me. They're going, well, they are because they're going after geeks. I mean, geeks will buy it, you know, for that. But what they're going after is the people who don't think it's any big deal to spend $1,000 on a watch, and there's a lot of people out there. The Galleria on the weekend is full of them.
Now, Apple is not, very famously, they are not releasing watch sales numbers. If you listen to their conference calls, which I do every quarter because we live blog the stupid things as much as I hate doing it, when you listen to their quarterly calls, they make it a point every time around to say, you know, we're making money off of the watch. They lump it into, I forget which category, there's an other devices category.
It's in with printers.
Yeah, they lump the watch revenue in there, and they don't release sales numbers ostensibly because they say that releasing sales numbers would give competitors a leg up on, I don't understand something, but that's what they say. But I mean, I've got to believe at the high end with the high margin at that, you know, $10,000 to $15,000 to $70,000 price, I've got to believe they're selling almost as many as they make. They're certainly not churning them out at the same rate that they would churn out, you know, the sport edition. But I've got to believe there's a big enough market of, you know, fashion watch obsessed, ridiculously rich people to where they're able to maintain sell through on those
The numbers that they give out, maybe not to the public, but you know, there's got to be a reason that Target and Best Buy wanted to sell the line and put it out there.
Did you guys see the Tag announcement where they're getting in? They're making an Android watch. It's a little bit underpowered, a little bit slow.
Oh, Tag Heuer.
Yes, Tag. Yeah, but I mean, they're banking more on the brand. But I mean, I think this might be a thing now. You know,
he may be underpowered, but the trains will run on time.
Although, here's what they do. Their watch is about the same. I want to say their watch is around, you know, low four figures. And then the thing is, after 2 years, you can actually pay the same amount you paid for that watch and get a real analog watch.
Yeah, that was, I saw that, and it was so weird. Like, after your stupid smartwatch that we sold you breaks, we'll give you a non-smartwatch.
Well, for the same price.
For the same price.
I guess the one thing to it on the smartwatch is, nobody's come out with one that's a lot cheaper that has similar capability and ability. So, you know, I think maybe part of this is just the scale of what they were attempting with the smartwatch.
So, Dwight, let me pose another question to you, watch related on the subject. One of the other objections from a lot of people to the high-end pricing was that, you know, theoretically people were saying, like, if I were to buy a $10,000 watch, that's an heirloom that I'm going to have in my family for, you know, forever and ever. I want to give that to my kids. And if it's a $10,000 smartwatch, in 3 years, it might be crap and wouldn't work anymore. Is that, looking at the fashion watch buyer mindset in your experience, is that a valid argument? Are these people oftentimes buying them to, like, invest in an heirloom that they're going to pass on to children or whatever?
I think that's a generational thing. Okay. I think older people think like that. Mm. I don't think people in their 30s or 40s who even have little kids think like that.
And disposable now, too, a lot more than we used to be. Right.
They
during
may be
the Depression
liking
era, people.
The excuse to get another one is, oh, well, now this one's obsolete.
Yeah, no, I think if you have the disposable income where a $10,000 Apple Watch or $8,000 or $7,000
is just a thing that you're going to be like,
it's just a thing you're going to have, you don't think, oh, I'm going to have. Now, the one thing you might do is you take that Apple Watch, you think, this was the first Apple Watch, I will set it aside, and that might end up being something. But I think for most people who are buying it, they're not thinking of it as an heirloom. It's another fashion watch, that the high end fashion watch they own.
Well, while we're geared up for Snark, we should probably do the sort of,
oh yeah, I want to hear your new bumper.
In the geek world, we hear about new gadgets and gizmos every day, but can they stand a dip in the Snark Tank?
Nice.
I think that's better than the
other
one.
I like that.
Especially just that.
I thought it
Jaws
was the same
Q
at first
in the back.
No, that was good.
Well, I basically put it on top of the old one. And so we've got some. I found some interesting ones. I think that, you know, it's been tough with Christmas, and there's not been a lot of new product announcements. But I found some other places to look, and so here's one that especially if you like the theme song to the show, the Theramini. This is from Moog. It's an actual Moog product. It is a theremin.
Right.
You know what that? If you've listened to Good Vibrations, you know, or yeah,
Bride of Frankenstein, any horror movie from the 1940s on.
It is a traditional heterodyning oscillator for pitch control, combined with a sound engine derived from the award-winning synthesizer Animoog. They basically reimagined one of the oldest electronic musical instruments. And it was Bob Moog's first love. That was the first thing he built was a theremin, and he actually like sold them, and he got to be a big deal about it. But one of the things they do is they have adjustable playing difficulty. At the maximum position, the theremini will play every note in a selected scale perfectly.
It's like an auto-tune
making
theremin.
It impossible to play a wrong note.
Now, theremin, for listeners who may not be familiar with this is traditionally an analog synth instrument that makes the weird music that you hear in, you know, sci-fi and horror movies, and you play it by, it looks like, it can take a number of different forms, but generally it looks like an antenna kind of thing, and you play it by moving your hand closer to the antenna and further away from it, and it produces pitch based on, you know, like this.
Right. You can keep talking. Yeah, this is the original theremin.
It produces,
Leon Theremin playing as an instrument.
It produces pitch based on like how close the position of your hand and the position of your fingers, because your fingers disrupt the electromagnetic. I don't know exactly how it works, but anyway, you play it by basically waving your hand around in space, and it's a very cool looking instrument. And it's also traditionally one that you can DIY yourself with very few components. You can actually make yourself a theremin.
There are kits out there, even. Yeah. Right.
There's a great movie, which if you're a fan of classic rock and if you're a fan of great guitar, called It Might Get Loud. It Might Get Loud has Jimmy Page,
Jack
The
Black.
Edge, Jack Black, getting together and playing guitar together.
Uh-huh.
And in the DVD version, at the
White.
End of it, Jack
Black.
Thank you for the correction.
Jack Black, all right, cool.
Thank you for the correction.
I almost got that snuck by. That was so cool.
So there is a scene at the end of it in the DVD. I think it's in the deleted scenes where Jimmy Page has brought a theremin. And he's playing it and playing like some snippet from a Zeppelin song on the theremin with The Edge and Jack White standing around kind of going, ooh, ooh. It's a great scene in a really good movie.
And it's not like easy to play. It looks easy to play and it's easy to fiddle around with, but it's not really all that easy to get very good at.
Well, you can hear every imperfection in the hand movements, which is why they do a lot of vibrato, because otherwise you're never going to hit that note perfectly.
But this has the auto-tuning thing.
So okay, you can adjust it based on your level, but you can put it all the way down to minimum where it will do the kind of vibrato and oscillating pitch that
Here's a trivia night question for you guys that you can stick in your back pocket for next time you go to bar trivia or play Trivia Crack. What fictional very famous serial killer is a theremin virtuoso?
Fictional serial killer?
The answer is
Jack the Ripper.
Hannibal Lecter.
Hannibal Lecter.
He's fictional?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, man.
There's your trivia
crack
question.
Oh, and
you
bought his cookbook.
To serve man.
I was just on the fava bean chapter.
It's a cookbook.
I know there's not one on the list, but can we talk about the Dark Force? Or I mentioned the Dark Force before we get...
I've been looking at the Dark Force. I know what this is.
This is awesome.
Is this is it more science-y or is it?
Oh no, you brought this to my attention, kind of. This is the in the vein of me buying everything one version too early.
the Russian
motorcycle company has issued a limited edition. They do every year. They do a limited edition vehicle. They do about a run of 80 for the entire world, and they're doing an all blacked out Dark Force. You know, I guess it's a hack. It's a what's the word that I'm looking for? Sidecar rig, but it has a 3-foot. Lightsaber attached to the sidecar on the inside in case you get into a sticky situation, you know, in some, you know, desert outpost on Tatooine.
It's
very cool.
As always, it's the, you know, when they do the limited edition cool product, it's always for the dark side. It's black.
Now,
and
because it's a Ural or Ural or however you say it, is it a Kickstarter or does it have a key?
No, there's an electric start on it.
Okay.
Although there is a kickstart that's still tied into it. So if, you know, the battery's dead or what have you can always kickstart it. It's a very old machine. It's a machine that more or less the super quick history is that Germany made Germany made a bike leading up to World War II. I think it was called like the BMW R71. It was a war bike. Russia didn't necessarily trust Germany, even though they made a pact with them. So Stalin sent some people in, procured 5 of them, started making more or less the same bike in Russia, and then because they were afraid of getting bombed out in World War II, moved the factory all the way up into the Ural Mountains, hence the name. And they've been making these bikes out of the same factory for 70, 80 years now, and they haven't really changed. They do some different paint jobs on there, and they throw some other things on
there, but for the most part, it's the same bike that's been made since World War II.
For 2015, we add cushioning to seat.
Well, they added, yeah. they added fuel injection. Well, yeah, so that's not like last year.
Yeah, so 2 years ago, they finally added fuel injection fuel and they injection, added disc brakes.
Disc brakes,
but
are
everything else
decadent.
Is the same. I already broke a piston in mine just because it's that kind of, you know, you expect things to break, but then once they stop breaking, they're fairly bulletproof.
Fuel injection, these for decadent Western.
It's a lot like driving a tractor. It's not like driving a motorcycle. It's very agricultural.
There's in the 90s, I remember there was the Impala SS when GM started doing rear drive big V8 cars again. The ad that was awesome was, you know, Lord Vader, your car is ready.
Oh, I remember that. I totally
you
remember
know, where
that.
Nobody does the Rebel. I guess the what would the Rebel? Maybe a Jeep or something.
Yeah.
This one drives a whole lot like a moisture farmer kind of vehicle out on Tatooine.
Moisture evaporators. So you got to have two robots, one to talk to the motorcycle. And
What was that geo tracker? The like you know four wheel, the like little off road geo.
The Suzuki.
I think tracker was one. There was a tracker, and then the Samurai were the two that were the tiny little rollover mobiles.
Yeah, I think the Rebel is the geo tracker.
They must have collapsed into rust because you only see so few for the years where there were lots of them. They went somewhere, and my guess
they're all
is
stuck
they just
in the mud.
Dissolved.
They're all back in the woods behind your house.
And so then, you know, on another one, this one is more less techy and more like, I don't know, either lets you work well at home or prepare for the zombie apocalypse.
Or in the spirit of Hannibal Lecter.
Fiskars has re-engineered both the hammer and the machete. They took their scissor technology.
Fiskars. the scissor company. Okay.
They're it's a Finnish company which dates from 1649.
Wow.
They were a pioneer of user-friendly design and best known for ergonomic scissors and small tools. Its latest products take that high-performance approach to two unexpected products: gardening blades and hammers. I call it a machete. So they aimed to identify problems people encounter in their daily lives and come up with a design-oriented solution. Striking tools, hammers, clubs, picks, and mauls were one category.
I just can't cut stuff fast enough.
And then the machete.
I just can't bang on stuff.
I feel
fast
like we
enough.
Still need scissors we can run with. Like there are other things that we should have gotten to before the garden machete.
They should have worked up to it. Well, maybe they're trying to get a quick tie-in or on Walking Dead.
There's definitely a lot of zombie prepper tie-in.
Awesome. Problems they identified with a machete, specifically as used in Central America.
Just didn't look cool enough, I guess. Looking at these things.
Got stuck in bone was one of the problems that they've engineered for. No, the machete axe looks the most foreboding, but still serves a purpose. The force generated by the tool is enough to hack through branches up to 4 inches thick.
How many zombies does that translate into?
I'm guessing a 4-inch thick branch is kind of like the top of a zombie's head.
Nice. Yeah, I was thinking go through a couple zombies in one swing.
Excellent. Like... They will be available in December 2015 for the striking tools and the clearing tools, the machetes, etc. Hit the market in early 2016.
Just in time for the zombie apocalypse.
There's links to all the stuff, all the articles we've talked about are linked from geekradio.com, by the way. And then finally on the Snark Tank, This one
might be for Dwight.
Yeah, I think this one, we were talking just before the show, he was showing in his backpack, he has a Grid-It organizer. Well, the company that makes the Grid-It, I think Cocoon Innovations is the company that makes Grid-It. They've made a backpack, and this one actually looks pretty cool. It holds up to 15-inch laptops. The thing that's different about it is it's got a main compartment that holds the usual things that are in the main compartment of a computer backpack, you know, a sleeve for the laptop and you know, pockets for various things. But the front, you know, there's usually that pocket that's on the very back of the backpack, or if you're looking at it from the back, that's the front that you see, that you can open up, and often it'll have like little pockets and places to put pens on. Well, they've replaced that with a Grid-It that's built into the backpack. And it seems to me that would be superior because it's not going to fall out. you know, the grid it thing isn't going to fall out. And it's also not just like thrown in with the rest of the stuff.
Does the flap over the grid it open all the way so you can get to it, or
Yeah, it opens out like.
I have one. The one I have actually, my wife bought. She didn't like it. She thought it was too heavy. It added too much weight to her backpack, and she gave it to me. And I have so many cables and adapters and chargers that I took it. And I like having those things organized, but the little elastic straps aren't that tight, and things fall out of it fairly easily.
So I wonder how, hopefully that would do better in this. But, you know, the thing to me is the stuff they're showing in the pictures are the kinds of little things that would just tend to just accumulate at the bottom of your bag, and it'd be a pain in the neck, and you have to get them out. Where this, or they'd have some pockets, and you'd put some of your stuff in, and then not have the right pockets for all the different things you want to put in or the variations on it. So
my calipers are so unorganized at the bottom of my bag, it's just insane.
But, you know, I think they're showing the versatility. It does seem, though, like it...
Dwight has... Well, seriously, all we have to do is say anything, and Dwight just goes, boom.
What else is in that bag, sir?
Wow, so can we talk about $1 million for just a couple seconds here? Whoa, in Bitcoin, no less. Go, Dwight.
He's got 3 zero-day exploits he's showing us. But
well, what happens when you pull it out, things like catch on the underside of the... And I actually have kind of thrown some things in there without... It has a little thing for you can put a like a tablet back there.
You know, it does seem superior to having a lot of gear bags to do the same thing on the grid.
It's a cool idea. I like it, but I can see if you pull something large out that things around it that aren't quite that big could also slide out once you take the tension off.
Also, I see where the back is sort of bends from having all the stuff on it, or is it made to be like
that? It probably
is
made to be flexible. Like I say, you can put like a tablet in there. So
there's that one. You know, it's not a cheap backpack, but it's competitive with the other ones that I've seen. So, it's
how
at
much
least,
is it?
I think the list price is $100. The places I've seen it, it's more around $85.
And what's the name of the backpack?
Cocoon. Let's see.
Innovations Cocoon Graphite 15-inch backpack.
Yeah. Graphite 15-inch back.
So you put it on, and you suddenly become much, much younger. And spaceships come.
And Brian Dennehy, or something. So as we wind down, I guess we can do the...
science that is weird.
Science-y thing.
My calculations are correct. When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're going to see some serious...
All right. Well, we got a couple. There's nothing like super dramatic this week, but this one was interesting. There's a drug. You know, they're testing different drugs about to fight Alzheimer's. That's obviously a key. You know, it's a big disease. We have a lot of population aging who are going to be vulnerable to it, and so there's a lot of benefit.
Wow.
Jeez. Ooh,
we love you, Dwight. We're
now, it's one thing to make fun of Jay for being old.
The researchers at the Salk Institute. So, yeah, they're a bunch of hacks, right? Now, the Salk Institute found a drug candidate aimed at preventing Alzheimer's disease. And the thing that they found is it seems to have anti-aging benefits such as better memory and cognition and better physical health when tested on mice, which is kind of odd. You know, they weren't studying something to like make your brain like it's younger. They were just the drug. The idea was that the stuff that goes after plaques in the brain, which was the normal thing they thought was a problem with Alzheimer's, they weren't seeing a lot of success. So they decided to aim at one of the major aim at one specific factor of old age, which is neurotoxicity. It's exposure to toxic substances that damage nervous tissue and neurons and is a major cause for Alzheimer's. And so they put it on, you know, so they came up with this stuff that would block it, called J147, and then tested it, and the mice looked and acted much younger.
No, what's the chance that we're going to have a race of super mice that are going to take over the human aging population?
Damn you, scientists! Why did you meddle?
They'll have to do battle with the robots from the Singularity. So
I hope I'm around for that. That's going to be fun, I think.
So the thing was, you know, usually they test Alzheimer's stuff on mice that have hereditary Alzheimer's, which unfortunately for people is only 1-5% of cases. So it's not real, you know, obviously that's still a substantial number, but it's not
a good indicator. Yeah.
So to test on a model closer to the majority of human Alzheimer's cases, the team used a breed of mice that age rapidly and experience dementia similar to age-related Alzheimer's. And they had three sets of mice, one that was young, one that was old, and a third that was old but treated with the J147. And they tested it, they found that their gene expression and the metabolisms also more closely matched the group of young mice, including increased energy metabolism, reduced brain inflammation, and reduced levels of oxidized fatty acids in the brain.
Sounds like I need me some of that. When can I get me some of that J147?
I'm sure Herbalife will be hawking it.
Add that in the Soylent.
Not in clinical amounts. You know, obviously, the next step is clinical trials on human patients, which they hope to begin in 2017. So it does, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, that the side effect being that you know, might look and think better is not bad. You know, the not having Alzheimer's, that's pretty good, you know, by itself.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
if you're also going to look and feel better, that's
it'll also be a hangover remedy.
And then finally, this one, I don't know, it got some exposure around. Scientists have discovered the remains of two extinct lion cubs from the permafrost of Siberia. The pair of infants nicknamed Yuyan and Dina, were estimated to be just a week or two old when they died 12,000 years ago. And they are amazingly well-preserved.
Lion cubs, you said?
They're cave lions, the most intact cave lion remains ever found. They are complete with all their body parts, fur, ears, soft tissues, and even whiskers.
Huh. So we're going to bring them back to life with some J-147?
It's possible they died after their mother left them in a cave to go hunting, and they were covered by a landslide, is how how Dr. Albert Protopopov of the Yakutian Academy of Sciences says that's how they explain such unique preservation of the animals. The species the cubs belong to went extinct at the very end of the Pleistocene era, around 12,000 years ago, so before the last ice age ended. The end of which corresponds with the close of the last ice age. I said that other part extemporaneously, but doesn't sound like they haven't yet been able to reanimate them. But you wonder what they do have.
J-147.
They do look like the. It sounds like the genome is not as intact as they would have liked, but
J-147 fixes everything.
But the other J Lee is going to be back to fix everything next week.
All right,
and that will be our Thanksgiving.
I think you could argue we fixed everything.
We did.
Our Thanksgiving Geektacular of one sort or another will be next week, and you can tune in then and hear the kind of full strength geek thang. I'm sure it will be very New Zealand centric.
No doubt.
All right. Well, so you've listened to another exciting episode of Technology Bites. I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
I'm Dwight.
And he's
Groovehouse.
We are out of here.
KPFT's Night Sounds will be hosting their benefit and silent auction Sunday, November 22nd from 6 to 11 p.m. at Dan Electro's Guitar Bar, East 24th Street, Houston, Texas, 77009. With live music by Acaria Sadu Experience, Lyric Michelle, Inzergo, Handsome Beast, David Crace with Captain Sky and Genesis Blue. The outside patio will be hosting an open invitation to the outside jam circle, so bring your acoustics, bongos, and tambourines. And don't forget to stop by the KPFT booth and hang out with Night Sounds radio personalities Lisa Blaylock and Jay Salceda, as they will help take your pledge of support. Thank you, Houston.
KPFT is seeking programming of all kinds for our new streaming channel. From music to talk, we want it all. Whether you're a seasoned veteran or a novice, we'd love to hear your big idea. If you're a local podcaster or know one, here's a chance to move from digital to FM. KPFT's web streaming channel replicates on our FM channel, so your idea needs to adhere to language and other policies mandated by the FCC. These projects also need to be non-commercial in nature. Interested? Just visit kpft.org and click on the Propose a Show tab towards the bottom of our front page. Multilingual programming is also welcome. Again, just visit kpft.org for details. This is 90.1 KPFT, Houston.